things get a little bit grim. But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah!
That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
Hi.
Hello,
Taylor.
Hey, Jenny.
Hi.
How's it going today?
Oh, it's going so good, but wait, I have a surprise for you.
Oh, my.
I've been sitting on this for the last hour while we hung out.
My heart is beating so fast! Oh, my God, they're so cute! Oh, my God, you guys, we have stickers!
We have stickers! We have a little bit grim stickers.
Hold on, I'm going to put one on my laptop right now.
Okay.
A little bit stickers.
A little bit stickers. Oh, my God, they're so cute and circular. I love them.
All cute things are rotund.
Okay, hold on.
Do you love?
I do love.
Hi.
So how can they get one?
Oh, well, you can get one by... How do we know they're going to get them?
Review?
Review. Leave us a review. The first... 50 people, well now 49 people.
Sorry.
The first 49 people to leave us a review, we will mail you a sticker. That's not going to work, Tay. We're going to have to edit this out.
What? Why?
How do we know their addresses?
They're going to have to screenshot it and then DM us.
Leave a review on the things. Screenshot it. DM it to us on Instagram, DM it to us on Facebook, or email us at alittlebitgrim@gmail.com.
Ooh, a jingle.
Do you like it?
I do.
Thank you. And give us a mailing address. It can be a public place. Doesn't have to be your home. We're not going to come to your home. We're very busy. But we will mail a sticker to you.
Oh, my God.
A little bit grim sticker of your very own. Oh, it looks so good on your laptop.
Doesn't it?
We'll post a picture on Instagram.
Yay. Oh, I'm so happy.
Yeah. So now we have stickers.
Oh, my God. It's our first piece of merch, Jenny.
That made me sweat.
It made me feel really happy.
Oh, good. I'm glad. So, yeah, oh that's what gosh. We have going on. So, we have stickers. Leave us a review. You'll get a sticker of your very own.
Oh, my goodness. But you got to do one more step. You got to screenshot it. You got to send it to us. You got to send us your address or you're not going to get one. I can't teleport to your house with a sticker, unfortunately.
Or if you just want, like, do, like, a good deed, no reward, you can just leave us a review.
Yeah.
You don't have to give us a mailing address. We would be happy to send you a sticker, but, like, you don't gotta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, welcome to A Little Bit Grim.
Yeah, if you're new here.
Welcome.
Welcome. We are doing true crime today.
We are. This is the big bad.
It is a big ol' big fatty boobaladdy murderer.
What? A big fatty boobaladdy
murderer.
Murderer boy. He's a little... stabby stab boy.
Little just slice and dice.
Yeah, he didn't slice and dice anybody. But more importantly, we're starting with you.
Yes, I am going to start. I also have a serial killer for you today. So mine is not nearly as notorious as Jenny's, so you definitely want to stick around for her story. But I am very excited to tell you mine. This actually started out as a grab bag. And oh. I realized as I was typing it in for grab bag episode that this was definitely bigger than our little mini episode. So I am going to start off with a journalist.
Ooh, okay.
I love a journalist getting down, getting dirty, finding the facts, finding killers. Yes.
It sounded like an advertisement for like journalism school.
You know, if I could do that, I would.
Yeah, you'd be great
at it,
honestly.
Sign me up. I will advertise for journalism school until I'm done.
Journalism marketing 101.
Yes. All right. So Thomas Hargrove is a former journalist who created a code and archive for every murder to take place in the United States since 1976.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
He has the largest catalog of murders in the country at nearly 752,000 murders.
Oh my God!
Which is 27,000 more than that are on file with the FBI.
Can you imagine that Excel spreadsheet?
Oh. Yes. I want to see it.
Such a guttural sound.
Yes.
True passion.
This discrepancy is due to states not reporting their murders to the Department of Justice.
Oh.
Hargrove has a code that sorts his data into statistical anomalies that can sort by love triangles, gangs, robberies gone wrong, etc. Some of these people have probably killed more than once, and Hargrove intends to find them using his code, which he has affectionately called the Serial Killer Detector.
Oh my god!
I want to sit down and have dinner with this person, and I want to see his Excel spreadsheet. That's all.
Show me the code!
Oh my gosh. Data and serial killers is like two of my favorite things.
I just want to see...
And like journalism. Like,
okay, this was curtailed for you.
Like, is he in my age group? Can I
befriend him?
Befriend him, love on him a little bit. I'm sure my husband would not appreciate. But he's got a serial killer.
Ryan would
data.
Understand. He would like want to come to dinner, but like he would get it.
Honestly. Yeah, he'd be like, "Peace out at dessert." You think? Are
yep.
you okay?
Yep.
What happened?
So I made pineapple habanero salsa earlier, and I didn't wash my hands. And I just touched my eye, and I got a habanero eye, but it's fine.
Do we need to pause?
No, we're a podcast, and I can listen with my eyes closed.
That's true. That is true. Okay. So, by a process of data aggregating, the algorithm gathers killings that are related by method, place, and time, and by the victim's sex. It also considers whether the rate of unsolved murders in a city is notable, since an uncaught serial killer upends a police department's percentages. Statistically, a town with a serial killer in its midst looks lawless.
Ooh.
In 2010, Hargrove noticed a pattern in Lake County, Indiana.
Ooh.
Which is where Gary is located.
Oh.
Between
19... 19- I mean...
yep.
There's a lot of crime to sort through up there.
Yeah, I'm sure that section of this Excel spreadsheet is...
thick.
A little long.
That's a couple of tabs.
A little long boy. okay, so... Between 1980 and 2008, 15 women have been strangled to death, and most of the bodies have been found in vacant homes.
Good God.
Yeah, that's okay. A lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
I can see why that would, like, go overlooked.
Yeah, though. Like, spread out enough and vacant homes. And we're going to talk about, like, the vacant home rate in Gary. But okay. There's definitely probability and reason as to why this has been... kind of overlooked.
Okay.
So Hargrove wrote to the Gary Police Department and gave his evidence that there could be a serial killer in Gary. The police basically said, sure, Jan. And ignored him.
Whatever you say, bud, we're on it.
Yeah.
It's fine.
He tried and tried and tried. The police must have thought he was a kook. A lieutenant told him that there was no unsolved serial killings in Gary, and the Department of Justice encourages local police departments to let communities know when there is a serial killer on the loose, but some places don't want that to be public knowledge, incite panic, all that kind of stuff.
Well, is inciting panic going to save lives?
Probably.
Okay, well, let's incite a little bit of panic.
Right, maybe some vigilance.
You know? Vigilante justice? Sorry, that's just me. I know it's dangerous. I really like it, though.
It's a line that we toe. I'm not against it in most cases.
I'm ready to foot that line, honestly.
You're like trying to do like a hokey pokey 1-2, like right over that line.
Toeing the line, electric boogaloo.
That's our new dance move.
Okay.
Okay, finally, the deputy coroner, a woman. Duh.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Reached out to Hargrove and agreed with his suspicions. She also previously reached out to the police department, but they refused her as well.
Ew.
After the coroner spoke with Hargrove, she added 3 more suspicious deaths to the list, making it a total of 18.
Ew.
Yep. So let's fast forward to 2014.
Okay.
It's October 17th in Gary, so I imagine that it's very cold. Africa Hardy is a 19-year-old woman fresh out of high school. She had recently moved back to Gary after spending a few years in Aurora, Colorado.
Ew, I love Aurora. It's beautiful.
Can you imagine moving from Aurora to Gary?
Can you imagine going back to Gary after living in Aurora?
The dread.
Ugh.
Oh, man.
Poor Henny.
Yeah. So she and a friend started dabbling in sex work and had ads on Backpages.com. Backpages has been shut down since due to allegations of human trafficking, but that is a whole nother story that I'll cover eventually. Mm-hmm. She got a call from a man who called himself Big Boy Appetite.
What?
Fucking yikes.
Wow. What? Got my interest, buddy.
But he said that he wanted to meet her at a local Motel 6, and she agreed. Africa texted her friend that she was meeting him and that she would follow up with her when she's done. When she never got the follow-up text, the friend called another friend, and they both went to the hotel to look for Africa. They found her at the motel. Africa was in the bathtub, and the water was running, and she had been strangled to death.
Oh, God.
Yeah, horrible. So they called the police, and the police found a broken fingernail, a shirt button, and a torn condom wrapper on the floor of the room. The beds had been moved away from the headboards, indicating that there had been a severe struggle. Because the friend had the phone number of Big Boy Appetite, it was relatively easy for the police to track the suspect down. They also had surveillance from the motel showing a man entering the motel room. The suspect's name was Darren Dion Van. So let's talk about Darren for a sec.
Okay.
So... Darren was born in the March of 1971. He moved around a little bit, but we know he spent his childhood and early adulthood in Indiana. In 1991, he joined the Marine Corps and was discharged in 1993. He received an other than honorable discharge.
Other than honorable? So, like, not dishonorable.
Right. So, I looked up the difference.
Okay.
Examples of actions that could lead to an other than honorable discharge include security violations, use of violence, conviction by a civilian court with a sentence including prison time, or being found guilty of adultery in a divorce hearing. This is not a definitive list. These are only examples. In most cases, veterans who receive an other than honorable discharge cannot reenlist in the armed forces or reserves except under very rare circumstances.
Okay.
Veterans' benefits are not usually available to those discharged through this type of discharge.
Okay.
He married a woman named Maria, who was 30 years his senior.
Wow.
Yeah, after he got out, after he was discharged from the military.
Okay.
They were married for 16 years, but they were separated for some time before divorcing in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
She says that she never knew him to be violent.
Hmm.
However, while he was in Texas, he sexually assaulted a woman and served 5 years for that crime. After this, he would have to register as a sex offender.
I love his sexual assault conviction.
Mm-hmm. I mean, didn't stop him from doing more heinous crime.
Well, does it ever?
No.
No. But it's better than probation.
Yeah. So he did serve 5 years in Texas.
I'm impressed. Good job, Texas, honestly.
Honestly, and we'll get into this a little bit, but it's one of those cases that, other than the police dismissing Hargrove, they did everything right. He served his time. They were checking up with him.
Okay.
He was on probation. He had a parole officer.
Okay. That's the stark opposite of my story.
Right. So I listened to a few podcasts about this case, and in all of them, they were like, you know, we expect to see, you know, the police mishandling a case, or especially in a case that has to do with a sex worker, like being kind of discarded.
Sure.
And it wasn't treated that way, even when it was sexual allegations. In other states, the states communicated with each other. Like, Texas called Indiana and said, a sex offender is moving out of our state into your state.
Oh my God, did everything right.
Yeah, in the
90s. So rare.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
It just goes to show, like, yes, even though we expect our police to be able to handle things, and sometimes they don't, even when they do, it can still go poorly.
Right.
If somebody is bound and determined to be a murderer,
they're going
to
be a
murderer. There's not a lot to stop them from doing that.
Sure.
So after moving back to Gary, he had a standoff with an ex-girlfriend and her boyfriend. He showed up at their home and dragged the girlfriend out of the home and poured gasoline on both himself and the woman and threatened to light them both on fire unless she repaid the $7,000 he said he owed her. Police intervene and Van was charged with a Class D felony and served 90 days. One of the podcasts I listened to, I think it was called True Crime All the Time, and it's two gentlemen hosts. They've been doing this for a very long time, so they have a large following, and they have a lot of listeners who write in.
Good job, guys.
And they had an officer who went to this scene.
What?
Right in, and they did an interview with him. And so it's the officer telling his side of how things went down.
Oh my God. That makes me true crime horny.
Oh my gosh. It was so cool to listen to. I wish I could like insert the audio, but I'm sure that I would have to like get permission from those guys since it was their interview.
Just go listen to their podcast.
Yeah, go listen to their podcast. It was kind of an early episode. Mm-hmm. So just go search Darren Dion Van podcasts, and theirs is one of the first ones that comes up. Basically, he was no stranger to police. He had a history of violent behavior, and even though he registered as a sex offender and checked in with his parole officer every month, he was still a cold-blooded killer. When the police arrested Dion the day after Africa's murder, he was wearing a shirt with a missing button. Mm. The rest of the buttons of the shirt matched the one at the crime scene.
Ah-ha-ha! He better button it up.
Oh, my heavens. He also had Africa's phone. And he confessed to the murder and also said that he had murdered 6 additional women in the Gary area. And he led the police to all 6 women's bodies.
Oh, my God.
Yep. So we have talked about Gary, Indiana before on the show, the Ammons haunting in episode 1. But I wanted to recap Gary a little bit. It used to be a busy, bustling city just southeast of Chicago. The population of Gary was just over 80,000 at the 2010 census, making it the 9th largest city in the state of Indiana. Once a prosperous steel town, it had suffered drastic population loss due to overseas competition and restructuring of the industry, falling by 55% from its peak of 178,000 people in 1960. That is huge.
Yes.
It suffers from unemployment, decaying infrastructure, and a low literacy and educational attainment levels. It is estimated that nearly 1/3 of all the houses in the city are unoccupied or abandoned.
What? They got a 66.6% occupancy rate in the city?
Boo, your owners are going to be real mad.
Listen, there's investors somewhere writing scathing emails to the city manager.
Your annual performance review is going to be a rough one.
You're not getting your NOI bonus,
no.
Honey Bunch. It's not happening.
Sorry, end-of-year raise is not going to happen for Gary, no. Indiana.
It certainly is unreal, almost, to drive through.
Yeah.
But it's like, on our way to Chicago, we just kind of skirt the city a little bit. There's the Amtrak train goes right through Gary. It's sad to see. It's like the lifespan of a city that, like, it was founded and it peaked and now it is rapidly on the decline and it doesn't have the resources that the people who live there need.
Right. And it would be such a great place to live as far as a location. It's so close to Chicago, but it has Indiana tax. It has Indiana insurance. It's got all the bonuses of living.
Like, Michigan is right there.
Yeah. And it's just...
It's beautiful marshland up there, too. Like, the scenery is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. If
there weren't so many dead and decaying buildings laying around.
And dead and decaying people.
True. Inside these dead and decaying buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So, these abandoned houses were where Van committed the murders and left his victims. So, let's talk about the victims. Africa Hardy, 19... She could walk into a room and just light it up with her smile and her laugh and just her presence, Lori Townsend, Africa's mother, told CNN. Africa never met a stranger. She loved everybody, and that was kind of her problem. She was a little naive on trusting people. Mm. Of course she was trusting. She was a baby.
Yeah.
She was 19.
You trust everybody when you're 19.
Yeah. Hardy's cousin told the Chicago Tribune that she enjoyed singing, loved kids, and eventually wanted to own a daycare.
Aww.
Tira Beatty, 28, left to meet a friend but never came back. Her family waited to hear from her for a few days but reported her missing in late January of 2014. Tira was also described as being very trusting. She had a small son, and when police suggested she may have run off to start a new life, her mother said that there was just no way she wouldn't leave her son. Mm. Anith Jones, 35, was last seen October 8th, 2014. She was reported missing 2 days later. Her car was found parked in a driveway of an abandoned house in Gary. Her sister told newspapers that Jones, who lived in Maryville, Indiana, ran a booth at a flea market. She was a kind and loving woman. Yolanda Noel, a Chicago police officer, told the Sun-Times, "She was my favorite sister. She was everybody's favorite aunt." Christine Williams, 36, was a mother of 4. Her mother-in-law said that she would often disappear, so they did not report her missing.
Oh.
Tracy Martin, 41, was reported missing on June 26, 2014. Sonia Billingsley, 53, was reported missing on February 7th, 2014. Tanya Gaitland, 27, had been missing since January of 2014. So that is a lot of missing people in a very short amount of time, which is what Hargrove believes is way more victims.
Yeah.
So if he was reporting 18 victims before 2010, and all of these victims were from 2014, that leaves a huge gap.
That's
in that data.
Prolific.
Yeah.
The amount of victims that potentially there could be.
Right.
And it's so sad to think that their families will never have answers.
Yeah, for sure. On May 14th, Van pleaded guilty to 7 murders. As a part of a plea agreement, prosecutors dropped the death penalty. On May 25th, 2018, Van was sentenced to 7 concurrent life sentences without the possibility of parole.
Can you get the death penalty in Indiana?
Yes.
I did not think we were a kill state.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yep.
All right. Well, that changes my plans.
Yeah, they had actually originally planned on asking for the death penalty, but when negotiations started between, like, the lawyer, Van's lawyer, and the lawyers of the victim's families, the victim's families said that they wanted him to rot in prison for the rest of his life. Ooh, and that death was too good for him.
I love that.
Yeah, I do too.
I love that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I'm necessarily against the death penalty, although I am, as far as, like, justice is concerned and, like, vengeance, I would rather you sit in prison for the rest of your life.
Same.
But I also don't want to have my taxpayer money dollars feed you that much.
So. I'm against the death penalty only because of the Innocence Project.
Yeah.
And how many wrong convictions.
That's huge. That is happened. Definitely a big problem.
Yeah. But other than that, I'm a big fan. Like, listen, if somebody goes out and kills a member of your family and you, like, go back and retaliate, that's the kind of death penalty I can get down with.
Sure. That's just eye for an eye.
Yeah. Vigilant. An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. But yes.
So that is the story of the serial killer, Darren Van.
Wow.
And that, Thomas Hargrove and his badass serial killer detector.
I love that. Serial killer detector. Like, he's on a beach.
Oh, yeah.
Just skinning. Beep, 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 beep.
With a metal detector. Listen, if I could walk up to a person and scan you for being a serial killer, you better believe I'd be in your business. Listen, all the time.
That's what my intuition is for. My intuition says run.
My intuition tells me to run from everybody. So,
I mean, that's fair. That's the issue with anxiety disorders.
Yeah.
Is that it makes intuition a little tricky.
Right.
But, wow, that's a wild. He's, like, right in our backyard, and I didn't know about it.
In recent, 2014, yeah. That's
wild. It's that story is a good parallel for this, another Chicago area serial killer.
Oh, I can't wait.
I'm going to start off by saying this is a doozy. It has taken me about a week exactly to do. And there might be moments where, like, Taylor has to insert some kind of peacock call or harpsichord tone so we can take a break.
My husband just texted me and he said he can't find my cat.
Which one?
Piper.
Oh, no.
She was there when I left.
She's probably hiding in a corner.
Sorry.
Very important real life things. We are two real humans.
We are. My black cat, Piper, she cannot be outside for that long. She will be too scared.
I'm going to eat a piece of chocolate.
All right.
While we wait for Piper updates. Was he doing a head count?
Probably.
I love him so much.
Yeah, he's more obsessed with my cats than I am.
I don't know if that's all the way true.
I watch that man talk to my cats when he thinks nobody's listening.
That's how you really know the true heart and soul of a man.
It was so adorable. I was getting ready for bed the other night. Or what was I doing? I don't remember. But I could hear him and he was getting ready for bed. And Happy was in the bed with him, and I hear Ryan go, "Happy cat, you're my best friend."
Oh, oh my my God, it's so wholesome.
Oh, man.
You Happy sweet Cat, boy. You're my best friend. To be fair, Happy Cat is my best friend, too.
He's such a sweet nuggle.
I love him so much.
All right, continue. I am sorry.
Wholesome. It's okay.
Let's talk about something not wholesome.
I'm going to tell you about John Wayne Gacy.
I'm so excited.
Everybody take a few cleansing breaths.
I'm going to open my second drink.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're getting lots of ASMR random...
weird sounds.
Weird sounds in this episode today.
We're a professional podcast. Okay. John, I like how I had to clear my throat like I was about to sing an opera.
You're about to go through a doozy, so...
This is about to be a doozy. When I was writing this, the note section on my phone tapped out and was like, you have to start a new note. It was like 300,000 characters or something ridiculous.
I didn't even know that was a possibility.
It was wild. Okay. John Wayne Gacy was born in Chicago, Illinois on March 7th.
Illinois?
I do that all the time. Listen. Taylor, cut that out. People in Illinois are going to be so mad at me. Illinois. I just say it because they're loud over there. They're Illinois-y.
Illinois-y? No.
Okay, fine. John Wayne Gacy was born in Chicago, Illinois.
Thank you.
You're welcome. On March 17th, 1942, I'm just saying he's a Pisces. Is he a Pisces?
What was it?
March 17th.
Yeah.
Yes, Pisces. He was the second child and only son of John Stanley Gacy and Marion Elaine Robinson. His father was an auto repair machinist and World War I veteran, and his mother was a homemaker. As a child, Gacy was overweight and not athletic. He was close to his two sisters and mother, but endured a difficult relationship with his father, an alcoholic who was physically abusive to his wife and children. Gacy seldom received his father's approval, later recollecting that no matter what he achieved, he was never good enough in his father's eyes. His father regularly belittled him, calling him dumb and stupid and comparing him unfavorably with his sisters. Despite this, Gacy always denied ever hating his father. One of Gacy's earliest childhood memories was of being beaten with a leather belt at the age of 4 for accidentally disarranging car engine components his father had assembled.
Oh my God.
It's...
Oh, sweet baby.
It's painful. Well, he killed 33 people.
Not at 4, though.
Well, not at 4. It's very sad.
I can feel bad for him until he kills people.
Okay. All right. Hang in there. It's going to get worse. On another occasion, he was struck across the head with a broomstick and rendered unconscious. When he was 6 years old, Gacy stole a toy truck from a neighborhood store. His mother made him walk back to the store, return the toy, and apologize to the owners. His mother informed his father, who beat Gacy with a belt as a punishment. After this incident, Gacy's mother attempted to shield her son from his father's verbal and physical abuse, yet this only succeeded in Gary earning accusations that he was a sissy and a mama's boy who would, quote, probably grow up queer.
That's horrible. But we also cannot be hitting children in the head. Make some serial killers.
Well, when I read that, I didn't know that about him. But there is a correlation mm-hmm. between, like, early childhood head trauma.
Oh, yeah.
And serial killers.
It's that, like, frontal lobe, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That
where your...
impulse control and empathy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good thing we got that anatomy degree.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Limbic brain? Limbic... No.
Pituitary gland? No. Hypothalamus.
Not close. Okay. That's not close to what any of us are saying. No, but I...
Hippopotamus. Okay.
The hippopotamus gland.
Your hippopotamus gland will make you mad.
Big depressed.
In 1949, Gacy's father was informed that his son and another boy had been caught sexually fondling a young girl.
Oh.
Right.
Okay, how old?
In 1949. And he was born... He was 7 or 8, yeah.
Ooh.
Right. So, his son and another boy had been caught sexually fondling a young girl. Gacy's father whipped him with a razor strap as punishment.
Oh my God.
The same year, Gacy was molested by a family friend, a contractor who would take Gacy for rides in his truck and then fondle him. Gacy never told his father about these incidents, afraid that his father would blame him.
My scientific anatomy degree just kicked in.
Oh, yeah.
AKA and? Google. low orbital cortex activity.
That's, yeah, it was right on the tip of my tongue.
I knew it was there. Sorry. Okay.
Because of a heart condition, Gacy was ordered to avoid all sports at school. During the fourth grade, Gacy began to experience blackouts. He was occasionally hospitalized because of these seizures and also in 1957 for a burst appendix. Listen, that happened to me. No fun.
It happened to you on Thanksgiving.
That did happen to me on Thanksgiving. I just remember being so pissed. I didn't get to eat any mashed potatoes. I was so mad.
Listen, I would be also very upset about that.
Yeah, me too. But I didn't kill people about it.
No. I don't know if I would have blamed you, but no, you didn't.
Gacy later estimated that between the ages of 14 and 18, he had spent almost a year in the hospital for these episodes and attributed the decline of his grades to his missing school. His father suspected the episodes were an effort to gain sympathy and attention and openly accused his son of faking the condition as the boy lay in the hospital bed.
Oh my gosh.
Like he faked bursting his appendix.
Right. What a dick.
What a dick. Although his mother, sisters, and few close friends never doubted his illnesses, Gacy's medical condition was never conclusively diagnosed. One of Gacy's friends at high school recalled several instances in which his father ridiculed or beat his son without provocation. On one occasion in 1957, the same friend witnessed an incident at the Gacy household in which Gacy's father began shouting at his son for no reason, then began hitting him. Gacy's mother attempted to intervene. The friend recalled that Gacy simply put up his hands to defend himself, adding that he never struck his father back during these physical altercations. Hmm. In 1960, at the age of 18, Gacy began involved in politics, working as an assistant precinct captain for a Democratic Party candidate in his neighborhood. The decision earned more criticism from his father, who accused his son of being a patsy. Gacy later speculated the decision may have been an attempt to seek the acceptance from others that he never received from his father.
Sure.
The same year, Gacy became a Democratic candidate. His father bought him a car with the title of the vehicle being in his father's name until Gacy had completed the monthly payments. The payments took several years to complete and his father would confiscate the keys to the vehicle if Gacy did not do as his father said. On one occasion in 1962, Gacy bought an extra set of keys after his father confiscated the original set. In response, his father removed the distributor cap from the vehicle.
Oh,
I don't know what it is. Probably important.
We did not go to automotive school.
We did not, no. Too busy being doctors.
Yep.
Gacy recalled that him taking the distributor cap and withholding it for 3 days made him feel totally sick and drained. So, when his father finally replaced the distributor cap, Gacy left the family home and drove to Las Vegas, Nevada. He found work within the ambulance service before he was transferred to work as an attendant at Palm Mortuary.
Huh. I don't think I knew that.
There's not a lot known about his time working at the mortuary, and there's a show where his sister is the main... she recounts a lot of this, and she said that while he was there working in the mortuary, they never had any contact.
Hmm.
And to this day, like, she still doesn't really know what he did there.
I wonder what the effect of that was on him.
Well, I'm about to tell you.
Oh, okay, great.
As a mortuary attendant, Gacy slept on a cot behind the embalming room.
Oh.
He worked in this role for 3 months, observing morticians embalming dead bodies, and later confessed that on one evening while alone, he had climbed into the coffin of a deceased teenage male, embracing and caressing the body before experiencing a sense of shock. This prompted Gacy to call his mother the next day and ask whether his father would allow him to return home. His father agreed, and the same day, Gacy drove back to Chicago to live with his family.
Repeat the part about shock again. I was too shocked.
He climbed into the coffin of a young male, and he embraced and caressed the body, and he experienced an internal sense of shock.
Oh, okay.
And the next day asked his mom to return home, and he left the same day.
What the fuck?
So I don't know if it was like so pleasing to him.
And it freaked him out.
And it freaked him out and he returned home.
Don't like it.
I don't like it either.
Don't like it.
A lot of sources say like pinpoint him working at the mortuary as kind of a jumping pad. Yeah. Upon his return, despite the fact that he had failed to graduate from high school, Gacy successfully enrolled in the Northwestern Business College, from which he graduated in 1963. Gacy subsequently took a management trainee position with the Nunn Bush Shoe Company. In 1964, the shoe company transferred him to Springfield to work as a salesman. He was eventually promoted to manager of his department. In March of that year, he became engaged to Marilyn Myers, a co-worker in the department he managed. During his courtship, Gacy joined the local Jaycees. They pop up a whole lot. I'm going to talk about them multiple times. Think like, you know, like, the Moose Lodge.
Okay, yeah,
or
yeah.
Like the Elks or whatever they are. That's what the Jaycees.
Okay.
Jaycees are.
Got it.
So he became a tireless worker for the organization, being named key man for the organization in April 1964. The same year, Gacy had his second homosexual experience. According to Gacy, he acquiesced to this incident after one of his colleagues in the Springfield Jaycees plied him with drinks and invited him to spend the evening upon his sofa. The colleague then performed oral sex upon him while he was drunk. By 1965, Gacy had risen to the position of vice president of the Springfield Jaycees. The same year, he was named as the third most outstanding Jaycee within the state of Illinois. Following his obligatory completion of a managerial course, Gacy relocated to Waterloo with his wife later that year. He opened a club in his basement where his employees could drink alcohol and play pool. Although Gacy employed teenagers of both sexes at his restaurants, he socialized only with his young male employees.
Mm-hmm.
Many were given alcohol before Gacy made sexual advances, and if rebuffed, Gacy would claim his advances were simply jokes or test of morals.
Sure. Ew.
Just kidding, unless you're serious.
Yeah. Ew.
Is super ew. Gacy's wife gave birth to a son in February of 1966 and a daughter in March 1967. Gacy himself later described this period of his life as perfect. He had earned his father's approval, which he had long sought, and when Gacy's parents visited in July 1966, his father apologized for the abuse he had inflicted during Gacy's childhood and said, son, I was wrong about you. Well, not that wrong. In Waterloo, Gacy joined the local chapter of the Jaycees, regularly offering extended hours to the organization in addition to the 12 to 14 hour days he worked managing three restaurants.
Wow.
Although considered ambitious and something of a braggart by the other Jaycees, he was highly regarded for his fundraising work. In 1967, he was named Outstanding Vice President of the Waterloo Jaycees.
I wonder where all these awards are now. Are they in the John Wayne Gacy Museum?
Somebody has them.
Ew.
I don't know.
I don't like murder memorabilia. I don't think I'm here for it.
I kind of like it. I kind of like it.
I'm okay with it if it's in a museum for, like, educational purposes.
Yes.
But, like, to purchase it for yourself to be like,
You can buy, like, is it Bundy drawings?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I guess, I don't know. Murder memorabilia, like, Jeffrey Dahmer, people wanted to buy things that were in his apartment that held body parts.
Oh.
And I don't know. I think
about
there's something very...
Something weird there.
Gross and disrespectful to the people victims. Who died.
Yes.
I think that's the issue I have with the obsession with, like, the actual murderer, is that it can be disrespectful to the victim.
I think it's very... It almost seems, like, consensual
yeah.
in what they did.
It's the notoriety that they so craved.
And finally got. And here you are feeding into that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, as
somebody, we say as we tell the stories.
I mean...
Listen.
Whoa, the hypocrisy, it hit me.
Oh, the turntables.
Oh, how the turntables.
Sorry, derail.
It's okay. So yes, he was named. I'm sure that there's some shitty like printout certificate in like a Dollar General frame that named him the outstanding vice president of the Waterloo Jaycees. At JC meetings, Gacy often provided fried chicken and insisted on being called Colonel for Colonel Sanders. He was managing, I don't think I mentioned this, he was managing fried chicken restaurants in Waterloo. Ooh, indeed. The same year, Gacy served on the board of directors for the Waterloo Jaycees, and many Jaycees in Waterloo were involved in, drumroll please, wife swapping, prostitution, pornography, and drug use.
Oh.
Oh. It all makes sense now.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Gacy was deeply involved in many of these activities and regularly had sex with local prostitutes.
Okay.
We're about to take a turn.
All right.
In August 1967, Gacy committed his first known sexual assault upon a teenage boy. The victim was 15-year-old Donald Voorhees, the son of a fellow Jaycee. Gacy lured Voorhees to his house with the promise of showing him pornographic films. Gacy plied Voorhees with alcohol and persuaded Voorhees to perform oral sex upon him. Over the following months, several other youths were sexually abused in a similar manner, including one whom Gacy encouraged to have sex with his own wife before blackmailing him into performing oral sex upon him.
Oh.
Gacy tricked several teenagers into believing he was commissioned with conducting homosexual experiments in the interest of scientific research, for which each was paid up to $50.
No. Mm-hmm. Uh-uh.
It's for science.
I'm paying you.
I'm paying you for science.
It's an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Scientific study. Yikes.
In March 1968, Voorhees reported to his father that Gacy had sexually assaulted him. Voorhees Sr. immediately informed the police, and Gacy was arrested and subsequently charged with oral sodomy in relation to Voorhees and the attempted assault of a 16-year-old, Edward Lynch. Gacy publicly denied any wrongdoing and insisted the charges against him were politically motivated. Voorhees Sr. had opposed Gacy's nomination for appointment as president of the Iowa Jaycees. Several fellow Jaycees found Gacy's story credible and rallied to his support. However, on May 10, 1968, Gacy was indicted on the sodomy charge. Gacy publicly denied any wrongdoing and insisted the charges against him were politically motivated. I lost my spot. Anyway, May 10th, 1968, Gacy was indicted on the sodomy charge.
Okay.
During his incarceration in the Anamosa State Penitentiary, Gacy, I couldn't say that without that accent. I don't know why my brain did that. Gacy rapidly acquired a reputation as a model prisoner.
Of course.
Within months of his arrival, he had risen to the position of head cook. He also joined the inmate JC chapter. The Jaycees. They're everywhere.
Why?
I don't know. I don't get it. Why is there a chapter in jail?
Right.
He increased their membership from 50 to 650.
Oh my God.
In less than 18 months.
What?
Yes.
Is it like a pyramid scheme? What was happening here?
I don't know. I don't know if it's like who are the people who wear the clapping monkey hats? What are those people?
Shriners?
Yes. Yes.
Maybe.
Freemasons.
Oh, okay.
Something. I don't know. He is also known to have secured an increase in the inmates' daily pay in the prison mess hall and supervised several projects to improve conditions for inmates at the prison. On one occasion, Gacy oversaw the installation of a miniature golf course in the prison recreation yard.
Shut up.
They put in fucking putt-putt.
He raped a teenage boy.
And then went to jail, became a star, put in putt-putt, and then was like, deuces.
I'm out.
On Christmas Day, 1969, Gacy's father died from cirrhosis of the liver. When told the news, Gacy collapsed at the floor sobbing. His request for supervised compassionate leave to attend the funeral was denied.
Oh, wow.
Gacy's family members claimed that during this time he was inconsolable. He was convinced that he was the cause of his father's death and that the shame he brought onto his family by the charges were the true cause of his passing.
I wonder why they denied that claim if he was so, like, well-liked and respected in the jail.
It is so rare to get granted like permission.
Okay.
To go do that. Like, it has to be something more than just like your dad is old and he passed.
Okay.
So anyway, Gacy carried guilt in his heart that he thought he killed his father.
Right.
Obviously, it was the many years of like severe alcoholism and that's what killed him. But Gacy never was able to move past that. And he carried that. His sister speaks about it, that after his dad died, he was never the same. And he carried that so close to his heart for the rest of his life. Anyway, he was granted parole.
Oh, okay.
With 12 months probation on June 18th, 1970, after serving 18 months of a 10-year sentence.
Holy... I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
That's not okay.
That's not okay.
I don't like it.
Mm-mm.
Do not collect $200. Go directly to jail.
Go back. Stay in jail.
So stay in jail.
Why are you out? Who let you out?
Who signed this paperwork?
It gets worse. Like, this is the complete 180 of your story, where the police did everything right. The justice system here
failed.
Ew. Gross. Okay. Two of the conditions of his probation were for Gacy to relocate to Chicago to live with his mother and to observe a 10 p.m. curfew, and the Iowa Board of Parole receiving regular updates as to his progress. So, on February 12, 1971, Gacy was charged with sexually assaulting a teenage boy who claimed that Gacy had lured him into his car at Chicago's Greyhound bus terminal and driven him to his home, where he'd attempted to force the boy into sex. The complaint was dismissed when the boy failed to appear in court. The Iowa Board of Parole did not learn of this incident, which violated the conditions of his parole, and 8 months later, in October 1971, his parole ended.
Wow.
The following month, records of his previous criminal convictions in Iowa were sealed.
Unreal.
I couldn't tell you why.
What? I just about asked.
Yeah.
I don't know. All right.
Couldn't tell you why.
Unbelievable.
So, with financial assistance from his mother, Gacy bought a house near the village of Norridge in Norwood Park Township, an unincorporated area of Cook County, a part of metropolitan Chicago. The address, 8213 West Summerdale Avenue, is where he resided until his arrest in December 1978, and where, according to Gacy, all of his known murders were committed. He became active in his local community, and his neighbors considered him helpful, willing to loan his construction tools and plowing snow for neighborhood walks free of charge. What a good guy.
Oh yeah, just swell.
Swell. Between 1974 and 1978, he hosted annual summer parties attended by hundreds of people, including prominent local politicians.
Ew.
Ew, indeed.
Oh, no.
In August 1971, shortly after Gacy and his mother moved into the house, he became engaged to Carol Huff, a divorcee with two young daughters. Huff, whom he had briefly dated in high school, was a very close friend of his younger sister. His fiancée and stepdaughters moved into his home soon after the couple announced their engagement. Gacy's mother subsequently moved out of the house shortly before his wedding, which was held on July 1st, 1972. 1 week before his wedding, on June 22nd, he was arrested and charged with aggravated battery and reckless conduct. The arrest was in response to a complaint filed by a youth who claimed that Gacy had flashed a sheriff's badge, lured him to his car, and forced him to perform oral sex. These charges were dropped after the complainant attempted to blackmail Gacy.
This is just like one red flag after another, and it's the same type of offense over and over and over again.
Oh, it's a whole color guard of red flags.
They're spinning in time. We're just like down, up, down, down, up, down,
drop, spin,
up.
Drop, spin. Yes.
5, 6, 7, 8.
In 1971, Gacy established a part-time construction business, PDM Contractors. It stood for Painting, Decorating, and Maintenance. Fun acronym. With the approval of his probation... Sorry, I dug for that. It was fun to find.
I bet you felt like a true victory.
I did feel like a winner, yes. With the approval of his probation officer, he was allowed to work evenings to commit to his employment contracts while working as a cook during the day. The business initially undertook minor repair work such as sign writing, pouring concrete, and redecorating, but later expanded to include projects such as interior design, remodeling, insulation, blah, 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 blah. In mid-1973, he quit his job as a cook so he could just focus on his construction business.
He had a lot of businesses.
He was, aside from the murdering and the assaulting, like a stand-up pillar of the community.
Right. Like, I don't understand what, I guess I'm not a murderer, so I don't understand what the missing link is here that forces people to fulfill a part of your brain that isn't, like, happy. And there, you have everything.
Yes.
You have everything. And you've gotten away with so many things that he should be in jail for.
Right.
And he's just like, doo-doo-doo.
Yeah, gotta I don't go know. Kill some people. This is why Mindhunter is so fascinating to me. Because it's like, I don't... You and I, as not serial killers, cannot understand the brain of a serial killer. So, by 1975, PDM was expanding rapidly and Gacy was working up to 16 hours per day.
That's not enough time to kill any people.
I know. It's insane. So, anyway, by 1978, the annual revenue of the business was over $200,000, and that's 1978. Currency.
Wow.
A lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
It is. And it probably had something to do with the fact that the majority of the workforce was high school students and young men.
Of course it was.
Gacy would often proposition his workers for sex and insist on sexual favors in return for acts such as loaning of his vehicles, financial assistance, or promotions.
Quid pro quo.
Squid pro ro, Mr. Powers.
Sorry. I could see it coming.
That was, I couldn't stop it. I couldn't stop it. He also claimed to own guns and noted telling an employee, Arthur Peterson, "Do you know how easy it would be for me to get one of my guns and kill you? And then how easy it would be for me to get rid of your body?" But nothing ever came from that.
If, oh God, okay. I mean, if somebody at work said that to me,
I would call the police so quick. It would make your head spin.
Right. Like, we be not taking those threats lightly, no, friends.
No, honey. But it was the early 70s. And,
The 70s. Great fashion. Wild time.
Wild time to be alive. In May 1975, Gacy hired 15-year-old Anthony Antonucci. In July 1975, he went to Antonucci's home. The two drank a bottle of wine and watched a heterosexual stag film, which is 70s talk for porn. A stag film.
What kind of friends get together and watch porn together?
I think, I don't know.
I hear about it, like, in these types of stories. Like, they just, like, had some beer, had some wine, like, put on a porn.
You want to come over and watch a porn?
What?
Taylor, can you imagine if I was like, hey, come over.
Let's watch a movie.
Let's watch a stag film.
Like,
can we just watch, like, Children of the Corn or Scream instead?
Yes. Like, the days of, like, porn movie theaters?
Oh, gross. That would not exist in Corona time, let me tell you. There's too many body fluids.
Ew. Ew. And so, I just can't imagine, like, being in a movie theater with, like, other people around. I get uncomfortable. 50 Shades of Grey. Like, I was like, I'm gonna need a minute, please. Please don't look at me.
Do myself.
Jesus.
And here you are with 100 other people who are also, like, uncomfy. So uncomfy. Anyway, Gacy wrestled Antonucci to the floor and cuffed his hands behind his back.
Oh my.
As you do when you're watching porn with friends.
Consent, my friends.
Oh, for the love.
If we could just have a yes out of that somewhere.
No one asked. It would be fine. Can you ask? Ask if your friend is okay with this. He was not okay with this. One cuff was loose, and Antonucci freed his arm while Gacy was out of the room. When Gacy returned, Antonucci, a high school wrestler, pounced on him.
Nice.
He wrestled Gacy to the floor, obtained possession of the handcuff key, and cuffed Gacy's hands behind his back like a fucking badass.
Yeah, he ninja'd himself.
Yes, he did. Gacy at first threatened Antonucci, but then calmed down and promised to leave if he would remove the handcuffs. Antonucci agreed. And Gacy left.
Why?
Right.
Ooh.
Gacy told him, not only are you the only one who got out of the cuffs, you got them on me.
That means there are more.
Yes. He told Antonucci, he continued to work for him. Continued to work at this the whole
ladies and gentlemen, it was a stroke.
It boggles. Okay, I gotta move on.
Yeah.
On July 26, 1976, Gacy picked up 18-year-old David Cram as a teenager hitchhiking on Elson Avenue. Gacy offered him a job with PDM, and Cram began working with his firm the same evening. The same evening. The 70s. There's no paperwork. There's no, like, can you bring me your social security card? And
so we can fill out your, like, I-9, right. W-2.
Right. How many things would you like to claim on your taxes? No.
Gonna need you to do a drug test.
Yeah, right, no. Because on August 21st, less than a month later, Cram moved into his freaking house. They moved in. He just moved him into the house.
The 70s.
The following day, Gacy, dressed as Pogo the Clown, conned Cram into donning handcuffs. Cram was drunk, and the handcuffs were placed on him with his wrists in front of his body. Gacy swung Cram around while holding the chain linking the cuffs and said that he intended to rape him. Cram kicked Gacy in the face and freed himself from the handcuffs. He's not very good at it yet. 1 month later, Gacy appeared at Cram's bedroom door with the intention to rape him, saying, Dave, you really don't know who I am. Maybe it would be good if you give me what I want. Cram resisted, straddling Gacy, who left the bedroom, saying, you ain't no fun. Shortly thereafter, Cram moved out and left PDM, although he did periodically work for Gacy over the following 2 years.
Guys, jobs are not that hard to come by. We do not need to be working for sexual predators.
No. Can you imagine somebody trying to, like, sexually assault you, and when you put up a fight, they go,
aw, you're no fun. See you Monday.
Bye. Come get your paycheck. Ew. So gross.
Out of there so fast.
So gross. Okay. It's about to get a little heavy.
All right.
In 1975, Gacy was appointed director of Chicago's annual Polish Constitution Day Parade. That sounds like a blast. He supervised the annual event from 1975 until 1978. Through his work in the parade, Gacy met and was photographed with First Lady Rosalynn Carter.
Mm-hmm.
On May 6, 1978, she signed one photo to John Gacy. Best wishes.
I bet she regrets that.
The event later became an embarrassment to the United States Secret Service, as in the pictures taken, Gacy could be seen wearing an S pin, indicating a person who has been given special clearance by the Secret Service.
Oh.
And a oop.
Oh.
Through his membership of a local moose club, Gacy became aware of a Jolly Joker Clown Club, whose members regularly performed at...
I don't like it.
No. was what gotcha?
The Jolly Joker Clown Club?
Jolly Joker Clown Club.
No.
I hate it.
Oh, that made my insides so itchy.
The members regularly performed at fundraising events and parades.
Channing, no.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they did. In late 1975, Gacy joined the Jolly Jokers and created his own performance characters, Pogo and Patches the Clown. He performed as Pogo at numerous local parties, political functions, charitable events, and children's hospitals. Patches was used at the grand opening of stores of his PDM clients. Gacy designed his own clowning costumes and taught himself how to apply clown makeup. For these reasons, Gacy is known as the Killer Clown. Gacy was also known to occasionally remain in his clowning garb after a performance. On several occasions, he is known to have arrived dressed in his clowning garb at a favorite drinking venue, the Good Luck Lounge.
L&L!
With the explanation he had performed at a charitable event and was stopping for a social drink before heading home, Gacy had another bar he liked to frequent in full clown garb, the L&L in Lakeside neighborhood in Chicago. A real creep fest of a bar with falling down ceiling panels and a crotchety bar owner named Ken who doesn't like Taylor and I very much.
We'll post a picture if we can find it.
Oh, I have it. I already have it. Yeah. Taylor and I got decently drunk.
A little shwasty-wasty.
A little shwasty-wasty, blickety-blackout.
And that's why we drank.
Oh, we were watching And That's Why We Drink show in Boys Town in Chicago. We stopped at the L&L. There's a delicious Chinese food place right next door. We ordered $60 worth of Chinese food. Hauled that shit up to our hotel room.
And watched Forensic Files.
And fell asleep on top of chow mein.
And Jenny wrote a strongly worded letter to the mayor of Chicago.
The governor. I forgot about that. About how shitty their tap water was.
Oh my God. Well, this is why we should not be allowed in public.
Oh my Lord Almighty.
We had a great friggin' time.
We did have a great time.
That Chinese food was A+.
Oh, it was bomb. Bomb as hell. And Ken, was he annoyed.
Oh yeah. The only reason we stopped eating is because we fell asleep.
That's correct. I literally woke up on top of noodles.
Oh, there was... we had open canisters of Chinese food
everywhere. Littered. If there was orange chicken over here, there's honey chicken over there, a crab rangoon.
We got into that mini bar before we went to dinner.
Ooh!
And we drank while we were getting our makeup on.
Uh-huh.
Went to dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Had drinks there. Went to the show. Had drinks there.
Went to the bar. Had lots of drinks.
Had lots of drinks there. And so by the time we got Chinese food...
we were done.
We had a fantastic time, though.
Honestly, that was one of my favorite, memories of us. I have a really fun video of you spinning around drunk in a chair underneath a falling down ceiling tile. Meanwhile, Ken looks on in the background disapprovingly.
We're the only people in that bar.
There was that dude in the corner. He was there for half the time.
That's true.
And we'll post the photos.
Sorry.
Anyway, I had to squeeze that in there.
Yeah, for sure.
So, Gacy is known to have murdered at least 33 young men and boys. Really killed the vibe.
Yeah.
26 of whom were buried in the crawl space underneath of his house. He typically abducted his victims from Chicago's Greyhound bus station, Bug House Square, or simply off the streets. Some victims are grabbed by force or conned into believing Gacy, who often carried a sheriff's badge and had spotlights on his black Oldsmobile, was a policeman. Other victims were lured to his house with either the promise of a job with PDM or an offer of drink, drugs, or money for sex. The victims are usually lured alone to his house, although on approximately 3 occasions, Gacy had what he called doubles. 2 murder victims killed the same evening.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Inside Gacy's home, his usual modus operandi, which is, do you know that's the MO?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's saying. I didn't know that. I found out right now.
I've been watching CSI since I was 10.
That makes sense.
Sorry.
His usual MO was to ply a youth with drink, drugs, and gain his trust. Gacy would then produce a pair of handcuffs to show a magic trick, sometimes as part of a clowning routine. He typically cuffed his own hands behind his back and surreptitiously released himself with the key, which he hid between his fingers. He then offered to show his intended victim how to release himself from the handcuffs. With his victim manacled and unable to free himself, Gacy then made a statement to the effect of, "The trick is, you have to have the key." Gacy referred to this act of restraining his victim as the old handcuff trick.
What a dick.
What a fucking dick. Having restrained his victim, Gacy proceeded to rape and torture his captive. He frequently began by sitting on the chest before forcing his victim to fellate him. Oh. An awful verb.
Oh.
He then inflicted acts of torture, including burning with cigars, making his captive imitate a horse as he sat on their back and pulled upon makeshift reins on their necks.
Oh my gosh.
And violation with foreign objects such as dildos and prescription bottles after he had sodomized his captive.
Wow.
To immobilize the legs of his captive prior to engaging in acts of torture, Gacy frequently tied their ankles to a 2x4 with handcuffs attached at each end. An act inspired by the Houston mass murderers. Several victims are dragged or forced to crawl into his bathroom, where they were partly drowned in the bathtub before Gacy repeatedly revived them, enabling him to continue his prolonged assault.
Wow, I did not know that.
It got dark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gacy typically murdered his victims by placing a rope tourniquet around their neck before progressively tightening the rope with a hammer handle. Mm-hmm. He referred to this act as his rope trick. Frequently informing his captive that this is the last trick, Gacy would then read the 23rd Psalm as he tightened the rope around his captive's neck.
What?
Which is the Lord is my shepherd, mm-hmm. I shall not want.
Yeah. Bit.
Occasionally, the victim convulsed for over an hour or two, quote unquote, according to Gacy, before dying, although several victims died by asphyxiation from cloth gags stuffed deep into their throat, with the exceptions of his final two victims. All were murdered between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. After death, the victims' bodies were typically stored beneath his bed for up to 24 hours. Gacy then buried his victim in the crawl space, where he periodically poured quicklime to hasten the decomposition of the bodies.
Wow.
The bodies of some victims would be taken to his garage and embalmed prior to their burial. It is believed by some investigators that Gacy engaged in acts of necrophilia with the bodies of several victims prior. Ooh. That scared me. On the afternoon of December 11th, 1978, Gacy visited the Nissan Pharmacy in Des Plaines to discuss a potential remodeling deal with the store owner, Phil Torf. While Gacy was within earshot of the 15-year-old part-time employee, Robert Peace, he mentioned that his firm often hired teenage boys at a starting wage of $5 per hour, more than double what he currently made. Shortly after Gacy left the pharmacy, Peace's mother arrived at the store to drive her son home so the family could celebrate her 46th birthday together.
Oh, so young.
So young. Peace asked his mother to wait, adding that some contractor wants to talk to me about a job. He left the store at 9 p.m., promising to return shortly. He was murdered after 10 p.m. in Gacy's home. Gacy later stated that at his house, he asked Peace whether there was anything he wouldn't do for the right price, to which he replied he didn't mind working hard. In response, Gacy stated good money could be earned through hustling, although he was dismissive of the statement. Gacy then duped Peace into donning handcuffs before stating, I'm going to rape you and you can't do anything about it.
Oh my.
So, when Peace failed to return, his family filed a missing persons report on their son with the Des Plaines police. Torf named Gacy as the contractor Peace's mother most likely left the store with to talk about a job. Lieutenant Joseph Konzinczak, whose son, like Peace, attended Maine West High School, chose to investigate Gacy further.
Yeah.
And this is the downfall.
Finally.
Woo! A routine check of his criminal background revealed he had an outstanding battery charge against him in Chicago, and he'd served a prison sentence in Iowa for the sodomy of a 15-year-old boy.
So at some point, was that unsealed?
I think because he was able to get to it because he was a police officer.
Okay.
It's
just like public record was sealed?
Yes.
Okay.
That's why he was able to open businesses and become a pillar of the community and blah, blah, blah. Cousin Sack and two other police officers visited Gacy at his home the following evening. Gacy indicated he had seen two youths working at the pharmacy and that he asked one of them, who he believed to be Peace, whether any remodeling materials were present at the rear of the store. He was adamant, however, he had not offered him a job and returned to the pharmacy shortly after 8 p.m. as he left his appointment book at the store. Gacy promised to come to the station later that evening to make a statement confirming this, indicating he was unable to do so at the moment as his uncle had just died.
Ah.
When questioned as to how soon he could come to the police station, he responded, you guys are very rude. Don't you have any respect for the dead?
Don't you have any respect for the dead?
Thank you. Ew. So gross.
Did his uncle actually die?
No.
Okay.
So,
of
course not. At 3:20 a.m., Gacy, covered in mud, arrived at the police station, claiming he had been involved in a car accident. Upon returning to the police station later that day, Gacy denied any involvement in the disappearance and repeated he had not offered him a job. So, police obtained a search warrant, and they went through the whole house, and they didn't find any indication that any crime scene had ever taken place in the house. They went into the crawl space.
What?
They crawled out of the crawl space covered in white powder that they had determined to be limestone that Gacy said, oh yeah, we have some moisture problems, so I toss it down there.
What?
Now, they did find several items that didn't exactly seem like they belonged to Gacy.
Hmm.
a school ring, various necklaces that didn't really seem like they really were in their right place.
Interesting.
So, they weren't able to find anything to put a warrant out for his arrest.
Okay.
So, they did the next best thing. They placed a 24-hour tail on him. Gacy, being the charming, charismatic fuckface that he was, befriended his tail and offered...
Oh, my God!
I know! Bold! They would have beers together.
Hey, man, you're supposed to be following me? All right, well...
Yeah, like, here... He was like, it's a hot day. He would make them lemonade. He would bring lemonade out to them in their car. They would be chummy. He would tell them jokes. He would dress up as Poke the Clown and go entertain them as they sat in front of his house.
Listen, I would be that petty ass bitch to make a tail lemonade. I won't lie. But I also wouldn't kill people. So.
Well, you wouldn't have a tail. But if you would, I could see you making them lemonade.
If you had a tail.
If I had a tail, you I would make them lemonade. Yes, I could see that. So, on one of the days, Gacy had brought the officers lemonade, and one of the officers knocked on his door, and he goes, hey, I'm so sorry. Can I use your restroom?
Ha!
And Gacy said, well, sure, bud.
Come on in.
Come on in. Use that dang old bathroom.
Standing out here in the cold.
Standing out here in the cold with all your lemonade. Come on in here, friend. And so the officer went in. And when he was using the bathroom, there was a vent that went down into the crawl space. And in his report, he stated that he smelt the very distinct smell of human decomposition. And that is how they were able to get a second search warrant for his home.
Did that cop know what he was doing? Or was he just like, I gotta pee?
I mean, if you ask him, he says that it was intentional.
Okay.
And that was a dangerous man. What, did he just have to pee because John Wayne Gacy gave him 5 beers and...
A lemonade.
And a lemonade. Maybe. In the driveway, and he just needed to pee. And who knows. So, they went down into the crawl space, and they found a body. And another, until they pulled 29 bodies.
That's so many.
From underneath the crawl space.
That is so many.
I can't even. I'm trying to think of like 29.
That's like a high school classroom where we grew up.
Oh my God. Unreal.
30 people in a classroom? 100%.
Yeah. Easy. Well, and there is, and we'll post this on the Instagram. Gacy drew
a map. I've seen that. It's terrifying.
It is absolutely horrendous. So. He was brought to trial February 6, 1980, charged with 33 murders. He was tried in Cook County, Illinois, before Judge Luis Garipo. The jury was selected from Rockford. And at the request of his defense counsel, Gacy spent over 300 hours in the year before his trial with the doctors at Menard Correctional Center. He underwent a variety of psychological tests before a panel of psychiatrists to determine whether he was mentally competent to stand trial. They said he was. He tried to convince the doctors that he had multiple personality disorder, and he claimed to have 4 personalities.
I did not know that.
The workaholic, the civic-minded contractor, the clown, the active politician, and a final personality, a policeman called Jack Hanley, who we referred to as Bad Jack. When Gacy confessed to police, he claimed to be relaying the crimes of Jack, who detested homosexuality. His lawyers opted to have Gacy plead not guilty by reason of insanity to have the charges against him reduced. They tried to present Gacy as like a Jekyll and Hyde character. The defense produced several psychiatric experts who examined Gacy the previous year to testify to their findings. 3 psychiatric experts at his trial testified they found him to be a paranoid schizophrenic with multiple personality disorder.
So that was true?
Meh. The jury deliberated for less than 2 hours. They found Gacy guilty of the 33 charges of murder for which he had been brought to trial. He was also found guilty of sexual assault and taking indecent liberties with a child. The conviction for 33 murders was then the largest number of murders charged to one single individual in U.S. history.
Wow. So he was like one of the first, right?
Yes. Yes, he was. And he was sentenced to death for each and every murder.
Oh my God. mean, I get it, but you can't die 33 times.
Illinois will try.
Maybe they could revive him like he was trying to do with his victims.
Oh, you are so deep and twisty in your brain. I love it so much, and I love you as a human.
Thank you.
He was set to be executed June 2nd, 1980.
What do you mean, said to be?
Set to be. Oh. He was set. It's a rumor. He's still alive today.
It's like, this should turn paranormal.
Surprise, it's a mashup.
That I didn't prepare for.
No. It's your worst nightmare.
It's my worst nightmare. Coming to class, got my homework done.
They set his execution for June 2nd, 1980. However, it wasn't until the morning of May 9th, 1994. This is crazy. I had to add this in. I know this is forever long, but listen. The morning of May 9th, 1994, Gacy was transferred from the Menard Correctional Center to Stateville Correctional Center in Crest Hill to be executed. That afternoon, he was allowed a private picnic on the prison grounds with his family. For his last meal, Gacy ordered a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken, a dozen fried shrimp, French fries, fresh strawberries, and a Diet Coke. That evening, he observed prayer with a Catholic priest before being escorted to the Stateville Execution Chamber to receive lethal injection. Before the execution began, the chemicals used to perform the execution unexpectedly solidified, clogging the IV tube, administering the chemicals into Gacy's arm, and complicating the execution procedure. Blinds covering the window through which witnesses observed the execution were drawn, and the execution team replaced the clogged tube to complete the procedure. After 10 minutes, the blinds were reopened and the execution resumed. The entire procedure took 18 minutes. Anesthesiologists blamed the problem on the inexperience of prison officials who were conducting the execution, stating that had correct execution procedures been followed, the complications would never have occurred. This led to Illinois' subsequent adoption of an alternative method of lethal injection.
Illinois.
On this subject, one of the prosecutors at Gacy's trial, William Kunkel, said he got a much easier death than any of his victims.
True.
And that is the story of John Wayne Gacy.
Homie, you did so good.
Thanks. That was long. I got a little tongue-tied.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
I'm eating a piece of chocolate.
Oh my gosh. All right. Well, let's end this before you eat that piece of chocolate.
No, I'm not going to. I'm going to eat it on air and you're all going to listen. I'm just kidding.
They're going to hate it.
I know. We can turn it off. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
I know it was long. It was twisty. It was dark. But thanks for hanging out with us.
Yeah. You know, we never promised you sunshine and rainbows.
Nope.
You are listening to a show called A Little Bit Grim.
It's literally in the title. What did you expect?
Yeah. So go follow us on the social media. We have Instagram, a Facebook page, and a Gmail.
We have a Twitter.
Do
the,
we?
The handle is taken.
So go follow us. And if you want a sticker, leave us a review.
And don't forget to screenshot it.
And send it over.
And send it over to your favorite social media.
Yeah.
We hope you have a good day.
Have a good day. And be kind.
Wash your hands.
Be kind and wash your hands.
Yeah.
All right. Goodbye.